Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
On DAB, digital radio, and 1089 and 1053 AM, after the lights go out, on TalkSport.
I'm Steve Harmison. I represented England in 63 tests, 58 One Day Internationals, and won the Ashes twice with my country.
And I'm Leo McKenzie. I've experienced life as both a Premier League footballer and professional boxer. In this series, we focus on elite athletes and their transition from their sporting careers to civilian life and the struggles which have followed.
Both Leon and I have had issues dealing with day-to-day life since departing the sporting arena. And during this series, we're joined by several sports personalities who've experienced similar battles following their careers in elite sport. Tonight on TalkSport, we're in conversation with a man who represented Arsenal as a player and managed both Reading and Leeds United, Mr. Brian McDermott.
Played for Ricks. Now, good chance for Ricks. Talbot's gone right in the middle there. McDermott coming up fast. Well, the substitution has worked, and McDermott has scored a fine goal.
And this is McDermott for Arsenal. He's got two to beat now. There's the first one. And he shoots in!
Brian McDermott is best remembered for his time as Reading manager, where he guided the Royals to promotion to the Premier League after winning the championship in 2012, an achievement which saw him named the LMA Championship Manager of the Year. He also managed at Leeds United, Slough Town and Woking, while as a player he spent 7 years with Arsenal in the late 70s and early 80s before going on to play in three promotion campaigns with Oxford United, Cardiff City and Exeter City. In recent times, he has worked for Arsenal as the club's international senior scout, while today he delivers presentations to audiences on the subject of mental health.
We'll be joined by Brian in a moment, and tonight's interview, Leon, features a man probably best known for his time in football management as opposed to his time as a football player. Were you expecting from the interview? It's, you know, lack of confidence and alcohol will probably dominate.
Yeah, I think we're going to hear honesty. You know, to come on and speak, you know, about vulnerable situations that have happened in his life, drinking being one part of that, which, you know, we want to get an insight on what he was going through, you know, what his thoughts and feelings and emotions were. How's it really affected him? What's your thoughts on...
I'm looking forward to hearing a man talk about making his Arsenal debut and not feeling as though he belonged, and even as he goes through his career, yeah, the things I've read about him, not getting on open-top buses because, yeah, he didn't think as though he belonged there, even though he played 50 times in the season for that team. And it's a Premier League manager, something that we haven't had. We've always had players, but it's a manager that's gone through these
first,
as well.
First Premier League manager. It's going to be an interesting conversation.
After the lights go out on Talk Sport.
Well, let's give a big welcome to tonight's guest on After the Lights Go Out here on Talk Sport. It's a very good evening to welcome Brian McDermott. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too
very
bad.
Well.
Not too bad. Here we've got a friend in common.
We
a good
have.
Friend.
Yeah, he's a good friend. Mr. Koppel, Steve Koppel.
Yes, Steve Koppel. That's my guy right
he
now.
He was always trying. When I worked with Steve, from 2003 to 2009, he was always trying to sign you.
That's quite surprising. He never let me know that.
No, he doesn't let other people
know. I think I just got into the Premiership with Norwich then. I think we was going through a bit of a a winning season. So then we got promoted that year. So it would have been 2004 or 2005, right?
Yeah.
He seems to be a fellow that doesn't say a great deal, but commands respect.
Yeah, yeah. Right, so listen, Brian, this is our third series on After the Lights Go Out, and you are the first guest we've spoken to who has both played football and obviously went into management in the Premier League. So to start off your playing career, you are best remembered with your spell at Arsenal. Was you 17?
Well, I made my debut at 17.
So did I.
Yeah.
So you made your debut at 17, but talk us through retiring.
Yeah, so what did I do? I had one year, after I retired from football, I had 1 year selling life assurance. Didn't have a clue what I was doing. Just got thrown into this world where didn't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back in the day, players didn't earn a lot of money, whatever level you played at, really. And I needed to get a job, so I did that. Then I set up a football in the community scheme at Slough for 2 years, and I really enjoyed doing that. And then I became a football manager. So I was a manager at Slough, at Woking, in the Conference. And then I went to Reading, and et cetera, et cetera.
Were you ready for retirement, or did you have a plan for retirement? Because we talked to people who had a plan. They still weren't sure when they got into the retirement what they were going to do. And the ones that didn't have a plan, they're the ones that sort of had the main troubles when they finished playing.
I had no plan. So I remember, Steve, coming back from... I was in Hong Kong. I played in Hong Kong. And I finished playing. And I sat in a house in Windsor that was lent to us by a friend of ours. My house was rented out at the time. And I just sat in the room thinking, what am I going to do? I didn't have a clue what I was going to do. I'd been in football since the age of 16. That's all I'd ever known. And I just tried to find a way, really. And work-wise, professionally-wise, I've been lucky. Mm. You know, I've never really chased a job in my life. It's just stuff that's just fallen for me, and I've just been really, really fortunate.
Brian, obviously, your early days in management, and as we spoke about Steve Coppen before, he's already got a placid, calm nature. What was your first lively management situation in terms of, was you a shouty sort of manager? Was you a calm manager? Like, what was the dynamics of your manager?
So for me, as a person, I'm quiet. I'm very, very shy. But I was taught shouting, you know, in dressing rooms. You know, back in the day when I was in dressing rooms in the 80s and the 90s, there was a lot of shouting going on. And I thought that was the way to do it. And when I was at Slough, in my first year at Slough, I did a lot of shouting. And I remember one of the players' wives rang me one day and said, "Do you know you are ruining my husband's life?" And I thought, what's she talking about? And I wasn't getting the best out of this guy. He's a striker. And I was constantly shouting at him, constantly criticising him. And I realised, I said, I'm doing to him what they did to me, those other managers. Mm-hmm. And I changed. I changed my ways and I thought, wow, this is just not correct. This is not the way that needs to be. I need to manage. It's, listen, it doesn't work, full stop. It never worked for me and I hated it. And I knew this guy hated it. And I stopped doing that and I started talking to him properly. And he started to score loads of goals.
Brian, just to return back to your Arsenal days, starting at the tender age of 17, I'm hearing that you felt kind of not part of it.
I felt like an imposter. I literally felt like, what am I doing here amongst these guys? I walked into that dressing room at 17, I think 18. You got sort of promoted from the reserve team dressing room to the first team dressing room. And I really didn't want to come into that first team dressing room environment. I thought there was a lot of big hitters there, a lot of players that were massively well known, and I'm in amongst that group.
Confidence wise, then you didn't feel.
I just didn't feel good enough. Yeah. I didn't feel
really,
but I was good enough.
Of course,
I can say that now that I was good enough. But mentally, I was very. I just struggled with it all. I struggled. I'm such a shy person. To go into that dressing room was an ordeal to me. You know, and
was
sometimes
anybody helping?
Sorry,
did anybody help?
No. No one knew.
None of the senior players?
No one knew. I didn't say it to anyone. You never said things like that in the 80s.
No.
I mean, I didn't say anything to anyone about anything until I was 53 years of age. And I've struggled with this till the age of 53. No one helped. And I was certainly not going to go to the manager and say, oh, by the way, I don't even feel I believe I belong here, because I think he would have made sure I didn't belong there after a period of time. I'd have been gone. Because that's how it was in those days. Yeah. So it was a real struggle just to get there and go through those doors of that dressing room at that time. And I remember, you know, we had Martin Keown there, Tony Adams was just coming through, Dave Rocastle. And then Charlie Nicholas turned up, and Charlie was a big superstar at the time, you know. And I love Charlie, he's a great guy. Mm. But I never felt I belonged in that kind of company.
As your career went on, do you feel like your personality being that way and quiet, do you think that sort of stopped it to where it could have probably gone?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I just wish I had someone to talk to.
Yeah.
I couldn't say that to my dad. I couldn't say it to my mum. I never said it to anyone. And I just wish that I'd have had a platform just to say to someone, am I abnormal to feel the way that I'm feeling about this situation? You know, when I left Arsenal, I went to Oxford and we got promoted. I didn't play a lot of games for Oxford. We got promotion. I went to Cardiff in the lower leagues at the time and got promotion and played a lot of games. I went to Exeter, got promotion, played a lot of games. But even the times that I got promotion, I played 45 games out of 46 for Cardiff. Mm. And you know they have that bus that goes round at the end of the season when you win the promotion or whatever. I didn't feel I was good enough to get on the bus.
Yeah.
I played 45 games and scored 9 goals and made numerous goals. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I look back at that now and think, God, that is so sad.
Yeah. Mm. Do you think times have changed since your playing days to your managing days because of the way people can talk about things and they can talk? So the 17-year-old Brian McDermott, if he came into a Reading dressing room in 2011, say, would his education be different to what yours was?
Yeah, probably. Is it into a point where you're thinking, yeah, we've nailed it now? No. You know, I look at the academies, I look at the kids in the academies. I look at those 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds, what the pressure that they're under from the parents. I mean, they train 4 or 5 times a week. They're pro footballers at 12 years of age. It's ridiculous.
Mm. Yeah, there's...
I can't have that. I just look at it and think, that can't be right.
It shouldn't be happening. That's cruel.
It's wrong.
Yeah.
They're not children.
Yeah.
And these kids need to be children. Mm. And that's the most important thing as far as I'm concerned. Mm. Because for me, I always look at the person first, not the football player. I look at the person and then we work on the football player. And I think that's the most important thing that I've learned in my time as a football manager and a scout and a player and all that stuff. Mm. Find the person first. No one ever said to me, how are you doing? Mm. And actually wanted to know the answer.
Yeah, something else which, interesting, you know, I was reading about it. You were born in England, but both parents were Irish. Mm. You decided to play for England under-18s.
Mm.
Was that a decision that you look back on and think, good decision, bad decision?
That's haunted me for 40 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Irish, so it's really strange. So I used to go back home to Ireland every summer. Mm. We had a farm in Ireland in County Clare. 100% my blood is Irish. I had a decision at 17 years of age. Don Howe was our coach. Obviously, he was involved with England. And I was scared of authority. Mm. And I think our family was scared of authority. And he'd say, well, what does a coach say? What do you have to do? Who to play for? Obviously, Don said England. Mm. And at that time, once you played a game for the youth team, you couldn't play for any other.
Yeah.
And when I got to about 18 and a bit years of age, I realised I'd made a mistake. But the thing was, I'd go to Ireland and I'd be English when I went to Ireland because I got an English accent. And I'd come back to England and they call me a plastic paddy.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had all of this going on in my life. And my mum came over and my dad came over in the 50s. So that lived with me for such a long time. And it's only now that I'm kind of coming to terms with that. You know, my blood is Irish and it always will be. And I was a boy. I was 17 years of age. And I've got to forgive that boy who was 17 years of age. And I'm trying to come to terms with just forgiving who that boy was at 17 years of age. He did nothing.
Mm. And the system's changed now. Yeah, you can even play up to 21s and then change as long as you don't play, which makes a huge amount of sense. But it's amazing when you're saying that you didn't feel as though you belonged. Arsenal was one of the best teams in the country at the time. Mm-hmm. They were one of the top teams in their country. And if somebody plays for their first game when they're 21, you think, well, he's got a chance, promising career. But when you play your first game at 17, that boy's going to make a name for himself.
Yeah. And you know what? I look back at it now and I probably stayed there too long. But I was always trying to fill a void. I was always trying to achieve something to fill a void, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in what sense?
You know, like the Irish thing was a big thing to me. I always thought, God, if I'd have got one cap for Ireland, it would have filled that void for me.
Okay.
But that was never going to happen. It got to a point where I thought to myself, okay, it's not about getting promotions as a player, because I've done that 3 times. So I've got 3 promotions. I've played in the top level. What about if we could get Reading promoted to the Premier League and I could become a Premier League manager? If I become a Premier League manager, that fills the void. And that's when I do my presentations about trying to fill a void and what that looks like. It don't work.
Yeah.
Anything external for me that I'm trying to fill a void with, you know, a new car, a bigger house, an extension to the bigger house, new suit. I got eight blue suits. When I was in the Premier League, I got eight blue suits because I wanted to look like Robbie Martinez.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm never going to look like Robbie Martinez, by the way. So all of these things that are trying to fill that void, yeah. I can't fill it.
Brian, a major detrimental issue in your life has been alcohol, and this came to a fore probably when you were managing both Reading and Leeds. When was the first time you started drinking alcohol for other reasons than socialising? Or did you think it was?
It's a good question. I can't answer that because I don't remember, but I did do that. I drank alcohol probably when I was at Oxford United, when I wasn't in the team because I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling, and it changed the way I felt. Alcohol was a solution to my problem. My problem was I didn't feel good about myself. I didn't feel good enough, just felt like an imposter. I didn't belong. So when I had a few drinks, it all sorted itself out. Mm. So that was a solution to my problem. I thought, oh, this is great. I've got a solution now. I don't feel. You know, the fact that I felt that I'm never going to get a cap for the Republic of Ireland. When I started to drink, I didn't feel that way. Yeah. I thought, oh, maybe one day things will change and I will get, something will happen. Mm. And then it got worse and worse and worse. And it probably, I wouldn't say tipped over the edge. In my 30s, my wife said that, you know, there's three things in our marriage. There's me, you, and there's alcohol. And, you know, that was quite early on.
How did that make you feel?
It made me feel more distant because I didn't want to get found out.
So you became more shut off?
Yeah, probably. I kind of isolated a little bit more and I was still drinking because I thought this was the only thing that I've got left in my life, as far as I'm concerned, that makes me feel better about myself.
So drinking came into a position of making you feel probably a little bit more confident or a little bit more, or just numb the pain?
Yes, in actual fact, it wasn't more confident. Mm. It was actually,
I actually
became even more boring. Yeah, you know, like I was dull. It was just numbing what I felt. And I couldn't deal with how I was feeling. And trying to fill that void. I'm trying to fill a void all the time, filling this void. I'm trying to look for external stuff to fill this void. And it ain't working.
The drinking, did it start because of the pressure of either career coming to an end? Was it pressure of basically to survive from a financial point of view?
Yeah, it wasn't pressure. I don't think it was pressure. Bottom line is, from the first time I picked a drink up, when I started, I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
So I have a beer. Some people can have one beer or two beers and walk away.
Yeah.
And that's what normal people do, apparently. Mm. I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
If you saw me down the road now and I had half a lager, just leave the vicinity.
Yeah.
Because I'll go missing for two or three days. I don't stop.
Two or three days?
No, I could do. Yeah. I could
really?
Do. Yeah, I could do. And look, it got to a point when I was just trying to fill this void, trying to make myself feel better. And it maybe came to a head in 2011. We had the playoff final against Swansea. And I'm thinking to myself, tomorrow I'm going to be a Premier League manager and everything's sorted because we're going to beat Swansea. I'm absolutely convinced we're going to beat Swansea because this is that side of me that comes out that says, guys, we can't lose this game. I know we can't lose this game. And we were at Wembley. There's 86,000 people there. It's raining. I can't hardly see. My glasses are steaming up. And at halftime, we're 3-0 down. We get back to 3-2. We hit the post to make it 3-3. Great game, if you like that sort of thing. If you're into a great game of football, obviously I just wanted to win. And we get beat 4-2. I drink till about 5 o'clock in the morning. I wake up next day and I thought, that didn't just happen, did it? It's over.
Yeah.
You're never going to fill that void that you know you can fill by being a Premier League manager. And then we got to start again. And you know the Championship, Leon. You know how tough that is. 46 games where you know the first 70 minutes of each game is just like a war of attrition. Mm. And then the last 20 minutes, something might happen. The game opens up. I know what the Championship looks like.
Saturday, Tuesday.
And then you win on the Saturday and then you've got to go to, I don't know, Derby or Norwich on the Tuesday. And then you've got to go again and you've got to try and win at Norwich. And that is relentless. Yeah. It's absolutely relentless. And there was no joy. There was just relief. So the whistle would go, we'd win the game, relief.
Mm.
Relief, just relief. Mm. No massive joy, but the downs, the lows, the defeats were so much harder for me than the victories were good.
Mm. And was it the alcohol playing a part then as well?
Oh, yeah. And I'd wake up feeling that anxiousness, depression, all of these things, and I never, ever wanted to talk about the alcohol side of it. I didn't want to talk about that. That is something that I wouldn't, that was non-negotiable. I didn't talk about that.
You just mentioned depression, which is something I'm familiar with. So how did you deal with, not only you got forming a drinking habit, but also depression now is starting to grab hold of you. How does that have affected everything for you? Because I know how it affected me, and I didn't drink.
It's so difficult to know what, you know, where that alcohol was and where that depression was, if that makes sense. It's like, you know, I know now that I don't drink that I have moments of feeling depressed, but I'm all right with that.
Yeah.
I can just, I don't fight it anymore. I used to try and fight everything. Now I just accept it for what it is. My first thought, generally, is I'll come into a room and I think someone's going to be on the other side of it and going to attack me. It's weird. Or a lift, if someone's going to come out of a lift, or if I'm on a tube or something like that, I'm underneath a tube, and I think to myself, don't jump in front of that train.
Mm.
It's just a thought. Now I know that I've just got to let those thoughts go. I don't fight them, I just go, it's just a thought.
So you've had those thoughts yourself?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So you've had sort of suicide?
Yeah, I've had those thoughts, you know, when I was manager at Leeds even, you know, when I was eighth floor of a flat in Harrogate. You know, and those thoughts would come into my head. And I know how to deal with those thoughts now, and I just accept them for what they are. I don't fight the thoughts. I just go, listen, it's just a thought. It's fine.
Mm.
It's part of me. That's part of my personality. It's not a problem. And you know what? One of the things about coming into and talking about this stuff that I talk about, I never really wanted to talk about it because I thought to myself, do you know what? I don't want to become across as indulgent. It's not indulgence because I'm in a really good place today.
Yeah.
Mm. It's just a process of learning about yourself or learning about oneself.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the thing that I've learned over a period of time, you know, to learn about yourself and to get stuff and to get people that you can talk to. And the message is you've got to open up and talk.
Big time. I want to go back to your Redden days because you mentioned about, you know, speaking at Redden. You joined as chief scout.
Yeah.
Alan Pardew as manager. How did you enjoy that role?
Good.
And you within few years, you bring in, was it Kevin Doyle, Shane Long from over in Ireland?
Mm. Good players.
Good players. Mm.
Good players.
How do you enjoy that role?
I like that role. I'm a scout.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like to be, a scout. You know, I fell into being a football manager. I never asked to be the football manager in 2009. Brendan Rodgers was the manager at the time.
Yeah.
He lost his job. Mm. But I felt at the time, look, I was qualified to do the job, to look after the team.
But the passion wasn't there, maybe?
No, I was 100% in. Because once I'd made my mind up, it's like everything else. If I'm in, I'm in. If I'm 95% in, I'm not in.
So
it's like I knew, and if any football managers are out there that want to be a football manager, if you're not 100% in, get out of it, because you have to be.
Mm.
And I was 100% in, because I knew the team was good enough, I knew the staff were good enough, and I just wanted to do what I had to do, and it worked out all right. But the scouting side of it, worked with Alan, who's a great guy, and really enjoyed working with him. Then Steve Coppell. And Steve, all Steve said to me was just find us players. That's all he wanted me to do, was to go out and find players.
Yeah.
But I also took the reserves as well. So I coached the reserves or managed the reserves. Nigel Gibbs, who was there with me, he did most of the coaching. I was out travelling everywhere.
Mm.
And listen, we had some great senior players there, you know, and good people. And I always think of football clubs only as good as the senior players that are in the dressing room, because they can make or break the dressing room. You know what it's like. You've both been in those dressing rooms.
You don't need a manager if you've got good senior players.
No one believe that, but I'm
telling
you.
Yeah, they do. And people look at the, when you say that to them, they just look as though you're an alien. They're just, really? And no, you don't need it. Because you don't need to tell somebody who's out of order, because a senior player will do it. And
do
it,
you know,
hurts
what?
More if you come that from somebody
that's playing. That is the key to being a good manager, is let the players manage the dressing room. And we had people like Joby McEnough was my captain, Mikael Edgewood, Casper Gorkis, you know, and young lads, Alex Pearson, people like that, great, great lads, Jamco, all of those. I could go through the whole group.
Yeah, good. That's a good bunch.
And that's a great bunch of people. And I used to say to myself, do you know what? I always think, well, actually, who would I go out and have a drink with? Actually, I'll go and have a drink with all of them.
Mm.
I'll have a cup of coffee with them now.
Yeah.
But it's like, I would go out with all of them. They were just great guys. And that takes a while. Mm. Took Steve 2.5 years to get promoted. Took me same sort of time.
Mm.
And that's what happens now. You know, managers get 2.5 games now.
Never
mind 2.5 years.
Brian, was there any emotions, you know, like getting promoted into the Premier League? Like, was you happy? Did you, you know, because I know when I'm going through depression in my own life, I can pretend a lot.
Mm.
You can have quite a big mask on. Was you in any of those types of moments with the success, but actually what Brian is actually feeling inside?
So, bizarre situation. We play Nottingham Forest in 2012, and if we win the game, we get promotion. We win the game 1-0. everyone's delighted, loads of people at the ground. I go out till about 3:30 in the morning, end up at a place in Reading called the Purple Turtle with my chairman, and we're having a big drink, and I wake up. I go back to Medeski Stadium at the time. I'm on my own, and I wake up in the morning. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. I've been drinking till 3:30, and I go to myself, is that it? I don't feel any different. And then I think to myself, OK, I know what it is. We've got to win the league. So if we win the league and the lads get medals, that's it. I've cracked it. Following week, Saturday comes. We play Crystal Palace. We drew 2-2. We get a point. We end up, we get medals. We win the league. No different. What is it? Team didn't play well enough. So all of these things keep coming. And then all of a sudden, I became someone I didn't like. My ego now is out of control. So that other side of me, that big ego, has become someone who I really didn't like. If someone said something to me I didn't like, I would tell them, you can't talk to me like that, you know who I am. Virtually. I didn't say, do you know who I am? But it was kind of bordering on, do you know who I am? I used to go into bars and I used to look at people thinking, do they know who I am? I wonder if they'll take a picture. And if they didn't take a picture, I'd give them a camera. It was like, oh, I need them to take a picture of me now. So I'm now getting off on the adulation. I'm going into games. Everyone knows I don't go shopping in my little town because if I do, people will recognise me. You know, I think I'm some kind of big superstar, which I'm certainly not. And it's certainly not my personality. But my personality changed with that Premier League. Because, you know, if you're Premier League, there's cameras everywhere all the time. You know, you've got all these cameras of Sky, Match of the Day, all of these. They're everywhere, constantly everywhere, press conferences. So I became someone I really, really didn't like. And that was ego. That was my ego. But I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. It was so bizarre. Everything that I thought was going to make the difference, it wasn't the difference.
Because you had a decent bout of games, winning games in the Premier League, right? And then you got Manager of the Month.
I got Manager of the Month. So I won the Manager of the Year in the Championship in 2012, whatever it was. And I got in the top six for all the managers, like Alex Ferguson, Brendan Rodgers, and, you know, that. But I didn't win it. So I left the LMA dinner that night thinking, you're not good enough. You didn't even win that. I'd already won the championship one. And I feel really sad when I say that, and it sounds really ungrateful. That's why I've never said it, because I don't want to speak about that, because it just sounds so ungrateful to say something like that.
When you're telling me, I don't see it as you're being ungrateful. I just see it as someone that is just constantly putting himself down, when there's good that happens in your life. You find something to say, well, actually, it's not actually good enough.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on.
Yeah, and at the time, if you were like in the sort of 70s and 80s, 90s, early 90s, you didn't have the scrutiny to what the Premier League give.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking and putting yourself down the way social media was at the time, because it was in the world, you're constantly getting barraged from the outside. Brian McDermott's not looking after Brian McDermott.
No. No, and the funny thing is that's so true. And I was pretty good at looking after other people in and around that work environment, but I wasn't looking after me, you know. And now I look back at it, and on a daily basis, I look after me first today. And that's not to be selfish, because, you know, when I get out of bed this morning, I have to do two or three little things that I do. You know, I do a bit of meditation. I do what I do. I actually write a gratitude list for my day and for how lucky I am to have heating, to have food, to have a roof over my head, to have a bed to sleep in, you know. And I never would have done that before.
So you do that list, gratitude list, every day?
Every day.
A certain routine?
Every day.
Morning
or night, I definitely do it every day.
I do a lot of writing.
Leon, for me, I have certain things, you know. I got to a point, my one ambition in life when I got to 53 was to get a good night's sleep. I couldn't sleep. I didn't sleep for 53 years, literally. And I sleep most nights now. I got a bit of peace. And all I ever wanted was a bit of peace.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
After the lights go out, Leon McKenzie and Steve Harmison in conversation with Brian McDermott on Talk Sport.
Brian, you've mentioned your problems with drinking and having too much alcohol. Would you say you were an alcoholic or would you say you was a functioning alcoholic?
I think the same applies to both. I was never someone who drank in the morning or the afternoon. Probably at 6 o'clock was a cut-off time. I think, yeah, maybe it's okay to have a beer now. Once I'd had a beer, I didn't stop drinking and it might be till 2 in the morning. But I wasn't drinking at work. I was doing my job, doing what I had to do. And there's a lot of people like that around.
There is.
You know, but I was waking up feeling really bad about myself and thinking, I'm not going to do that again.
Did you wake up and have a drink? Or?
No, never. So never did anything like that. No, never. See, people think people who've got a drink problem wake up in the morning and have drinks. Some of them do, some of them don't. I never. I had a propensity to pick up a drink and I knew if I picked up one drink that I wouldn't stop. And that would be the same for me today. If for whatever reason I went to have one drink, I wouldn't stop.
Some people will pick up a drink and they'll have one, two, three, but don't really know the levels of when they can stop.
Mm.
It happens quite a lot with what I see. Doesn't necessarily make them an alcoholic as such, but you can pick up a drink and you keep going. So once you pick up one, you're like literally, that's you.
Yeah.
Is that until pass out or is it just you've just had your fill and that's me going home?
No. So I got to a point when I would go out and have a few drinks with some people. Obviously, I was aware of who I was, my position in my job, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go home. Mm-hmm. Maybe I was at Leeds or go to the flat and have a drink at home on my own. I was, I was on my own at the time and I was scared to go to sleep, scared to go to bed. And I'd go to bed at night and I would literally think, I'm not going to wake up tomorrow. And there's a part of me that didn't want to wake up in the morning.
Yeah. How did it impact your sort of time at Leeds?
Oh, my time at Leeds. Interesting, my time at Leeds. I went there in April after I lost my job at Reading in 2013. And there was 5 games to go and they were on a losing run. And I was wanting to wait till the end of the season to go in the summer. But I think they lost 5 or 6 games on the spin. And they were worried about getting caught and sucked into the relegation. So they wanted to bring me in. So I went there. I never touched a drink for that month and I was at Leeds. And I told all the staff, no drinking. I was like the anti-drink police for about a month and a half. And I didn't have any drinkers around me anyway. Nigel Gibbs doesn't drink alcohol, full stop. You know. And we won the first game. We won the second game. So we'd had enough points to stay up. They were great. The people at Leeds were very, very good to me. You know, we won 3 out of 5. And then the following season, we started the season. Okay, we needed a lot of doing, so the team needed a lot of work, bits of work. If we'd have beaten Blackpool on Boxing Day, we'd have gone 4th in the league. Mm. So we were right in amongst it, and then the wheels fell off for a period of time, which was a really difficult time, and new ownership came in, Massimo Cellino came in. Very difficult time, personally and professionally. I found that very, very difficult. And my mum was struggling at home as well, and I never got to see my mum, and I was up in Harrogate, living in Harrogate, trying to manage Leeds, knowing that my mum was struggling at home, so it was a really tough time for me.
Brian, obviously when you was at Leeds, you was living on your own for quite a while, so you was away from your family.
Yeah, I wasn't with my family yet.
So how did that affect you? It affected me when I was playing, when I was away from my wife and kids at the time I was playing at the back end of my Charlton days. Probably the worst thing for me to be isolated in a hotel by myself, going to training, leaving training, going back home, going into my hotel room, literally shutting the curtains and going to sleep.
Yeah. Well,
and obviously you know, drinking was in your life. It's right there, isn't it? So now you're on your own and without your family. How did you cope with that? What was your coping mechanisms?
Well, I left my wife for a year, basically. So I walked away from her. You know, I'd known her since I was 18, 19 years of age. And I didn't speak to her for nearly a year, texting and stuff like that.
Why did you feel you had to do that, Brian, if you don't mind me asking?
It was my stuff. It was down to me. And, you know, I don't like talking about this, but it was something that I felt that, you know, I'm always trying to solve what my so-called problems are. Mm. You know, what's my... So, or maybe that's my problem, my relationship or whatever. And it certainly wasn't. It was... Everything was about me. Mm. You know, I was very self-centred and I walked away from her for a year. And my daughters.
I get it.
And, you know, I look back at that and I think, well, was I that person who did what he did? Mm. And I was. Mm.
Yeah.
And I still look back at that and I have a certain amount of shame and guilt, but... You know, I look back at that person. I look, but I can't stare. Mm. I can't keep looking back and revisiting that time because that's not me.
It cripples me. Yeah. If I look back at the person that I was and what I did to my ex-wife now, I know that if I look back at that person, that I've probably carried guilt for the best part of 15 years in terms of what the dynamics of our relationship was. And, you know, you don't wake up with your kids every day. That family unity's gone. You'd be surprised what you can try and fill it with. And I found that really, really difficult. So I totally understand, you know, that guilt that can get hold of you.
And because of that, I drank more. Because of the guilt and shame. Right. You know, you have that guilt and the shame and you drink more.
You said you'd left for a year. How did they cope with seeing you being the person, the drinking, the sort of identity stuff that you had? Did they pick up on it? And ultimately, did it make the family bond stronger in the end?
So the only person who knew I had an issue was my wife.
Yeah.
My youngest daughter, possibly. My other daughter, yeah, maybe.
How did they cope with that?
I can't answer that, Leon. I don't know. I just look at that and I just think, well, I tell you what they did do. They showed me unconditional love. That's what they did do. That's what I know that they did do. How they cope with it, it's hard for me to even go there, how they cope with it. Because it's I instigated it. Because I instigated it, it's difficult for me to talk about that. Because I wouldn't want to do anything that was going to hurt my wife and my daughters. And I did. But I don't do that anymore. That's something that I still can't get my head around it. But that's how it was at the time. So, yeah, I was at Leeds for 1 year, 50-odd games, actually, and left there. And actually, the one thing that really upset me at Leeds, and it did, and it's something that Leeds fans don't know, or some do, is that Massimo Cellino was saying that I went on holiday at the end of my time at Leeds because I disappeared after the season had finished. Now, I knew I was on my way. I knew we were going to come to an arrangement and I was going to get the sack. I knew that was happening. Most important thing for me, I need to go and see my mum because my mum was struggling.
Of course.
And he was saying about, like, you know, I was on holiday and where is he, where's he gone, etc. And that wasn't true. That was the one thing that did upset me, and that was a personal thing for me. My mum died in the June of that year, so it was about 3 or 4 weeks later she did die, and I managed to see her before she died. And to be fair to him, he wrote to me about that, Massimo Cellino, and, you know...
Yeah, she wrote.
He wrote me a letter to say, I'm sorry about your mum. You know, he didn't say, I'm sorry that I said you went on holiday, but I did what any person would have done. I just disappeared.
Yeah. You say you talk about time at Leeds coming to an end. How did that make you feel? Because you mentioned you had that family issue with your mum, and Massimo Cellino, he didn't really make it easy for you after that getting a job.
Well, it wasn't that so much. I think, you know, he was the owner, so he did what he did. And listen, from day one, I knew that I knew it was curtains, really. Mm-hmm. You just know. Mm. New owner comes in, generally a new manager's in trouble. So Massimo's style is he wants a head coach, not a manager. I was a manager.
Mm.
You know, like nowadays, everyone's a head coach. You know, I look at it now and I think, well, I was a manager. I wanted to have something to do with the transfers and the players coming through because I was a scout as well.
Mm.
So I knew my players, and that was important.
Did your players or even some of the coaching staff have an inkling that you was vulnerable at that time?
No.
Didn't show them, did you?
It's really interesting. I spoke to Nigel Gibbs the other day, was the closest to me. Nick Hammond was my director of football at Reading, and I actually said to Nigel, did you know? He said, I didn't have a clue.
Yeah, they never do. No. They never do. Even some of my former teammates.
Some wives don't know.
Yeah.
That's scary.
And that's nothing to do with Nigel. Mm. That's how
we had to act.
You can have that mask of what so-called resilience looks like. you know, that's a buzzword nowadays, resilience. You know, okay, you lose the playoff final in 2011 and you win the league the following year, 2012. Is that resilience? I would suggest it's resilience, but no mental well-being. So having resilience with no mental well-being, what's the point? You're getting out of bed every morning, you feel like terrible.
Brian, after your issues with alcohol, today you no longer drink. What was the moment when you realised it was time to stop? And what were the chain of events which allowed you to do so?
Yeah, nothing dramatic. Well, probably dramatic, I don't know. I was working at Arsenal at the time as a senior international scout at Arsenal. I was travelling all over the world watching games. The last 5 or 6 days before I stopped, I'd had a drink every night. And on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, 2015, I think Arsenal were playing in a cup game and it was a 12 o'clock kickoff and I was invited to the game and I went to the boardroom and I said to myself, I am not drinking today. I am definitely not going to drink today. Got into the boardroom, got to the bar at the boardroom. I was going to have lunch with three other guys. And I said to the guy behind the bar, can I have a sparkling water? And he went, here you go, get me a sparkling water. I went down, sat there, and then there was four of us sat there having just about to have lunch. And the waiter said, do you want red or white? I'm supposed to say, can I have another sparkling water? And I said, red. So there you go. So I had half a bottle of red wine. I go back after the game. It was about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. It was a morning game. I get on the train. I don't have a drink at the pub in Marylebone. There is a pub there. I go to the train station, get to Beaconsfield where I live, and get a taxi home. And I say to the taxi driver, oh, just drop me at the end of the road. For some reason, I didn't say drop me at the end of my drive and just go in my house. So it's now about 6 o'clock and I decide to go left. So left is where my pub is. So I think, okay, I'll go there till 9 o'clock. I go in there till 9 o'clock. I walked out of there at 1 o'clock in the morning. I walked back to my house and I put the key in the door and I thought, I'm going to go straight upstairs to my bed. Instead of doing that, I went to the kitchen. Another bottle of red wine. Woke up next morning. I went to bed about 3. I woke up and I went downstairs and I was living back in the house with my wife. She let me back into the house. We weren't together, but we were living together, you know, because we've known each other such a long time. And I said to her, Sarah, I can't do this anymore. Can you ring someone for me? I need help. And she rang the doctor. I said, I can't do it. And she rang a doctor and I spoke to a doctor and I then went into some group meetings and that was 15th of February 2015 and I've not had a drink since. Listen, I've never woken up in the morning in the last 7.5 years and thought, I wish I'd got drunk last night. Not once.
Do you feel proud?
I'm proud of you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm proud of you because of
what you've done.
It's not, you know.
Do you know what? I have a daily program of what I need to do in a daily. So it doesn't matter about my last 7.5 years. If I drink today, it's all ruined straight away. I know where that's going to take me. So, you know, I'm proud that I'm a good dad today. I'm proud that I've got my wife back today. I'm proud that I've got my kids that speak to me and show me unconditional love. I'm proud that I'm a granddad today. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm proud that I actually know what friendship looks like. And I'm proud that I know what unconditional love looks like because it was shown to me. So all of those things I'm proud of. You know, I reflect fondly on my time at Reading now, which is probably not a bad, is as good as it gets for me. I reflect really fondly. I'm doing these two presentations in tomorrow and Wednesday in Reading and it's sold out and I'm like, oh, it blows me away. I'm thinking no one's going to turn up and they're both sold out.
What I want to know
is what's the difference between Brian McDermott now and the 17-year-old who didn't have a great deal of self-confidence, couldn't have, because what you've just described there to me is somebody who actually quite likes himself.
Yeah, I don't mind myself now. I like myself and I know what's important now. I know what my values are and that's the key.
You went back to Reading as manager in 15, finished in 16, and then you returned to Arsenal as the international scout. Just talk me through some of the players, because the likes of Saliba, who's actually at Arsenal now, you know, you pushed a Haaland and there's one or two others that you pushed towards Arsenal. I'd love that job. Watching young players.
Do you know what?
And throwing them into the club.
That's the one job that I lost that really... I love Arsenal, you know, and I'm so proud of what they're doing at the moment. I love Arsenal. I was gutted to lose that job. I really went, you know, we had COVID and we were pulled in and the scouts went and left. Yeah. No one was travelling. It's just a fantastic football club, an institution of a football club. and look where they are at the moment. And, you know, the players, you know, Saliba was a great example. We Ty Gooden, who was our French scout, he shouted him out. And my job was to watch the players that all the scouts had watched in the different parts of the world. And my boss was Franny Caggio, who's a great guy. And we ended up getting Saliba in as a kid, 18 years of age, top talent. And he's showing what he can do now. But it was a team. It was a team of people. For me, obviously, I've been involved in bringing a lot of players to different football clubs. But it's about a team. It's about the manager, what the manager wants. It's about the head of recruitment. It's about the director of football. It's about all the other scouts. Mm. And just working as a team for me, I'm a team guy. I want to be involved with the team. I was always a reluctant manager because you're kind of on your own as a manager. Listen, that's not completely true. You've got great staff, and I always had great staff, but it is that feeling of loneliness when you lose, and that feeling of standing on the line. And you understand this.
All eyes on you.
Yeah, and it's like this feeling of 90 minutes on that line. It's really difficult to describe. It doesn't matter what it is. Slough Town versus Runcorn, or Reading versus Manchester United at Old Trafford, stood next to Alex Ferguson. The feelings are the same.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
Exactly the same. When you go 1-0 up, you get your heart rate goes to about 130, 140, because you know you've got everything to lose.
Brian, Russell Brand, I'm a big fan of. I think he's a super intelligent person. You know, he's kind of been through his own sort of journey. He came to one of your mental health talks.
Yep.
Talk to me a little bit about that in terms of...
I've known Russell for 7 years. He's a good mate of mine. And he's a great guy. Forget, you know, who you see in the public domain. Yeah. The amount of stuff he does for people is incredible. I've read his books. I see him regularly. He's just a great guy. He's a family man. Yeah. And he helps an awful lot of people.
And he come to watch you speak?
Yeah, I sort of spoke to him about coming, and he said, like, yeah, I'll come.
That's brilliant.
And he came just to support me, really.
Yeah, brilliant.
You know. And he said to me afterwards, I've seen him on the Sunday, I spoke on the Wednesday, he said, would you mind if I give you a little bit of feedback? I said, Russell, please, if you could give me some feedback, I really would appreciate it. But he asked me, would I mind giving if he gives...
Because he's very...
That's what
speaker.
He does. Yeah, he does. Yeah. Russell can talk.
I'd love to be able to speak to him.
He does. He broadcasts every day, Russell.
Yeah.
But he's a great guy.
What was his feedback?
His feedback was good. And he told me one or two things that maybe I could have added, which I've added to the presentation. Yeah. So it was just nothing but good. You know, he's just a lovely man. He's just a real wholesome, good man. And, you know, like you say, he's had his demons in the past. And he lives a day at a time like we all do.
And that's the thing. Brian, do you feel like you would get back into football, managerial or scouting?
Do you know what? Like I said to you, I've never chased a job. Scouting I love. Something came for me that I really fancied, with a good club that I really wanted to get involved with. Yeah, possibly. But I do my presentations now. I do a little bit of scouting for myself, trying to put one or two younger lads from the lower levels to the higher levels. And I do that.
How do you find doing presentation works?
It's probably the most rewarding thing I've ever done. Scariest, but rewarding. Yeah, I was in this prison the other day and did it in this prison. It was incredible. I'm doing a bit of mentoring, just finishing the League Managers Association mentoring course.
You're doing a bit of mentoring,
which is good. And, you know, just trying to give a little bit back.
You say mentoring, I'm at Crystal Palace, under-18s doing their mentoring. I absolutely love it.
Brilliant. And that's so important for someone like yourself.
Oh, I love it.
You know, and I've got people like yourself, Stephen Reid. I just spoke to Reid. A lovely guy. I love Stephen Reid. You know, and people like that, you know, that can get amongst it. And when they stop managing, and Reid was a top coach, top of what he does. Great player. To have him around a football club, to have yourself around a football club, to me that's so important, because you know what it's like with a lot of the players. A psychologist comes in, players don't talk to him because they're thinking that he's going to repeat to the manager what you've just said. Leon, if I'm 17 and I'm talking to you at 44 now, oh my God, my world changes.
This is what I'm saying.
That's what, you know, you know that world that I'm trying to get to. My world changes. If I'd have had someone to say, what do you think, Leon? Because I'm really struggling with this. And I would have been able to, not after the first chat, because you never get it after the first chat, but later on, you know, and that could be the same in the corporate world. That can be the same in a dressing room, in an office. Just get people around, start talking to each other. And that's the key.
It's 8 years since you've touched alcohol. How is life for Brian McDermott today?
Yeah, today I'm good. I still go to loads of meetings. I don't drink a day at a time. I'm not going to drink today. And then tomorrow I'll look after tomorrow when it comes. I'm doing my presentations. I've got a wife back. I've got my daughters back. I'm a grandfather. Yeah, my life is calm and I've got peace and I sleep at night and that's good enough. Mm. And you know what the funny thing about it is? I'm still ambitious.
Yeah.
You know when you sort of talk, I hope sometimes I think, does this sound soft? I'm not soft. Mm. I want to be as good as I possibly can on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. I've learned there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. And that's all we all ever want to be. And especially when people listen to this show, on behalf of people that are listening to this show, I can only say thank you, my friend. Thank you. Been brilliant. This last hour has been fantastic.
Your vulnerability, sharing your experiences, honestly, so grateful to have you on and pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.